This week in the show, weaponizing your iPad, we like Ping, and cast a dead actor for your next project. All this and more on This Week in Media. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Lon Seidman of LocalOnlineNews.tv. I am joined by a superb panel who are going to talk about some superb happenings in media and all things digital these days. Joining me is our co-host, Tim Street from MDialogue. How are you?
Yeah. Hey, how's it going, Lon?
Tim's got a little bit of fan noise today. His computer is working around the clock delivering advertising to folks across the world. So we'll be hearing a little bit of that as we go. Brim DeForest from Cordly, which is a new and exciting operation. So why don't you tell us about what's going on there?
Yes, sir. We are based here in sunny Los Angeles, and we're working behind the scenes to change the way that the music industry deals with the distribution of content. So it's exciting stuff. We're just a couple months old, and we're moving very quickly.
It's always exciting to get a startup going, especially with all of the exciting developments in media. So congratulations on your work. And joining us is filmmaker and business development maven Zach Louie. How you doing?
Oh, wow. I love the maven. That wasn't staged at all.
Not at all. I'll invoice you for that later on. So
thank you. I'm doing well. I've got a Pages document open in front of me with notes on this edit I'm working on, and there's only three lines, so that scares me.
Either you're really good or there's more to come.
It says, line one, intro. Line two, office shots with her voiceover. Line three, shots with her voiceover.
Well, then, you've got your work cut out for you. So
yeah, I had enough tea this morning.
And tea and coffee and everything else in between. So
yes.
We have got a ton of things going on out there, and the first actually came to us from a TWIM listener who emailed us about pay-per-use broadband. And there was an article, actually a couple of articles in GigaOM from Joe Weinman, which kind of detail his thoughts and perhaps the industry's thoughts on where all of this access cost is going. And in the article, Weinman kind of focuses on the fact that we might have to start paying per bit versus the all-you-can-eat buffet that we have now. And our listener wrote in with some concerns saying that if he was a video creator, it would scare the heck out of him. You know, is this something where we go back to the days of having to describe exactly how much bandwidth that video will consume and will, for independent producers, hurt us as we are producing some of this really cool content that we want people to watch? But if people had to pay every time they click the play button, what would that mean for us? And let me start with you, Zach, because you're producing content as we speak with a very short edit list in front of you. What are your thoughts on this? If we were having to pay per bit and suddenly there was a transaction involved with playing everybody's content.
This is terrifying. I hope that this does not happen. right now, we kind of live in like an a la carte system, you know. It's like, hey, listen, we're going to throw down $50, but that gets you your unlimited Netflix, that gets you your Facebook addiction, that gets you your E-bombs world addiction. We can go buy something on eBay, we can go buy something on Amazon. And in the meantime, if you want to hop on to your Google search bar and search for some stuff that I'm producing or Tim's producing and blah, 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 you know, that's just something you add into the mix. It's proprietary. It's on top of that. But if there's a literal, like, cognitive decision when you're doing things, like when you stream a Netflix movie, I think it's around 500 to 700 megabytes depending on the length of it that's going through your system. I'm just curious, because that, like I said, that would be terrifying to me, knowing that people that may watch my things because they are free, because it's free content, because, you know, I mean, that's essentially what draws us to a lot of things, the ease of access. And we've jumped on top of a distribution model where we understand that we can't charge for our content that we're pushing. And we're monetizing it in different ways, but only because this medium is free and easy to access for people. But I think if we change that, I'm reading the article right now, and man, that's just some rough stuff. And I hope it doesn't happen, because I myself, with all the data that goes through my computer, and for a certain legal, I mean, absolutely legal transactions, that would be not good for me.
It would be for a lot of us. And what was interesting about this article is that Wyman's pontificating that perhaps as the general public, which doesn't perhaps consume as much bandwidth as the people on this show or the people listening to the show might, would opt for a cheaper plan, knowing that their usage isn't so bad, therefore making the all-you-can-eat special cost a heck of a lot more, given that all the hogs would be left. Brady, as someone who's working on a startup in a media space, what's your thought on this, and do you hope there's some logic being brought to bear on this potential?
Yeah, Lon, it's a great question. I think at the end of the day, it's just supply and demand, right? I think that the tiered access is probably more likely than metered, at least in the short run. I think ultimately, if we look 10 or 20 years in the line, I think that all of our content consumption will be metered, similar to an electrical bill or any other utility. So the more you consume, the more you pay. But I think at the end of the day, consumer behavior is such that, you know, we all attempt to avoid bill shock. So I know I overpay. You know, I have an unlimited plan for you know, my cell phone. That's because I know that it's going to be consistent. I would rather, you know, pay a little bit more on the front side than have, you know, wide variances in my monthly bill, depending on my usage. But at the end of the day, I think that tiered access is a great way, as much as I'm absolutely against it from a moral perspective. But for the telcos, I think tiered access is a great way to assess fees against power users. And allow light users to actually, you know, to obtain some serious cost savings. And at the end of the day, that's really what it's about. There are a small percentage of users who, you know, use the majority of bandwidth out there, and the majority of users who use very little. So at some point, you either have to penalize the aggressive advanced users who are pulling down a lot of, you know, bandwidth through the pipe, or you have to incentivize them to pay more.
And that's basic economics, I guess, right? It's just the way it shakes out. Now, someone who consumes a lot of bandwidth is Tim Street. Tim, what does this mean for advertisers? How do you even display an ad if someone's going to get charged for the streaming of it?
You know, it really depends on how things shake out with net neutrality. I mean, as we are recording this show right now, today is the last day that you have an opportunity to get your comments into the FCC concerning net neutrality. They're going to take a look at it next week. So we'll see if something finally happens in that neighborhood. But, you know, it looks like internet freedom is going to win out over net neutrality. And by that, I mean that, you know, whoever wants to charge more for whatever service they're providing, or whoever wants to, as far as ISPs go, whoever wants to restrict bandwidth will be allowed to, because the internet will remain free with no government regulations to prevent whoever owns the pipes from controlling the pipes. So if you're into a content producer, not a real happy day, but if you are a large ISP, things are looking pretty good right now.
Can I make a point?
Sure.
I'm just really, really interested. Think of it this way, Tim. The market right now for even professional internet content, television, we'll just call it internet TV, that we're producing, is really convoluted right now. It was less convoluted in 05, less convoluted in 07. It's super convoluted now with great high-definition camera technology being so affordable. With people becoming more savvy as they're more exposed to well-made content on the web, kind of borrowing from each other. So a lot of people are making really great stuff. But if something like this were to come into play, I think that it would discourage a lot of people that aren't really into the content game. They're not really into production. They're just doing it because it's got such a low barrier of entry. I think that this would raise the barrier of entry, and it would raise the way people would get the content. It would make users, I'm saying users in quotes, more targeted, which would sort of mean that they would give more impressions. It'd be less views, but it would be more a higher impression number, and the views would be targeted versus just stumbling upon it, and the market would be less convoluted, so you have less competition. So less competition, better viewers, and the people that still want to make, like, really, really want to produce this content would still do it, and the copycats would sort of eventually fall off, I think, if this were to come into play. But it would suck either way.
Either way, it would, and you know what? It would dramatically change the landscape of how all of us do our work. And speaking of people who like to restrict bandwidth, Comcast is having some trouble these days trying to get the merger with NBC taken care of. The LA Times' Joe Flint reports that Comcast is facing some regulatory hurdles, given the fact that they have so much control over the internet in this country now, and the fact that NBC has a lot of internet properties, including Hulu, and that there seems to be a lot of discussion in Congress, in the Justice Department, and in the FCC, which is desperate to try to get some handle of net neutrality, that this deal is going to get complicated if it wasn't already complicated. Does it even matter to new content providers who takes over here, Tim? I mean, is this something that we all need to keep an eye on, or is this just the death throes of some of the old media mergers taking place here?
Well, you know, if you go back to the 1980s when the FinCEN rules went away, it used to be that if you were a network, a distributor, you were not allowed to own a certain you were only allowed to own a certain percent of the content that was on your network or your distribution channel. And since those rules have changed, you can own a lot of things. And because of that, about 85% of the media, or I guess 85% of all media, is created by five companies. And with this merger, that may drop it down to four companies. So the independent voice and the free speech voice, those are coming into consideration here. And if you have to pay to get your voice heard and you don't have money to pay to get your voice heard, that can definitely limit your speech. So I think that's one of the issues. But for some reason, I think the Comcast-NBC merger will happen no problem.
I do too. I think at some point this deal is going to get done, and for Comcast, as they're struggling to keep some of the content business going in their growing arsenal of media, I think that it's definitely going to go through at some point. Zach, let me ask you, as an independent filmmaker and business development maven, what is your take on this? This is big business, but we all want to get a piece of it. So have you been following this, and what do you think this is going to mean for some of your work?
Well, I think first and foremost, we just need to collectively address that Comcast is the devil. That everyone, you know, that's sort of the mantra around the world.
Your personal opinion.
Okay, fine. Unless they're crawling this show right now and they're listening through the webs, Comcast, I love you. I will take 1% of that $30 billion merger and I'll be happy.
Very good. And actually, they've been very kind to provide bandwidth for today's show, courtesy of my cable bill. So hopefully they'll... so Zach's comments are their own, and hopefully we can keep the show going as we go on here.
No, this is just one of those things where we're talking about it because we're sitting on a show called This Week in Media, and we're very, very geeky men. But the general population, I mean, like, I'm gonna go ahead and throw a number out there. I've completely pulled off the top of my head, but let's just say 90% of internet users don't think about this. They don't care about this. This is going to be in lieu of something like a Facebook profile update that happens, and they're like, "Oh, this sucks." They complain about it for 2 days. Like, Hulu might get bottlenecked. You know, things might change. It's going to be a higher level of access for people like us to put stuff in. But fortunately for people like Comcast and NBC, we're such a small segment of the market. It's, you know, it's just about making some cash and about making things a little bit easier for everyone, you know, better ways to pull money off of ad dollars. So, I mean, essentially, we can talk about it, we can complain about it, but like you guys said, I think this is going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think much is going to stop it at this point. But Brady, what's your take on this? Because your startup is working with groups big and small, big parts of the music industry, and obviously artists who might be independent artists out there. How do you see this shaping up, and does it affect your business? And if it doesn't, how do you feel just in general how this might impact smaller content creators?
Yeah, well, you know, to Tim's point, I think that there's a reason that the FinCEN rules were put in place. When the content owner also owns the pipes that the content's being distributed on, it kind of kills the elements of the free market that make capitalism work. So I think in this case, the Comcast-NBC merger is going to go through, Certainly the way that Washington works, it's kind of comes down to whose pockets you line, and they've got plenty of cash to to make all the deals that they need to make this to push this deal through. I think Julius Jankowski, a very, very smart guy, who has a lot of work ahead of him in the next 2 years. I think that this deal is somewhat of a landmark for the SEC, and so I think they're going to put the pressure on. And I think that they're going to probably slow it down considerably, but I don't think that they have necessarily the political capital to stop it, even if it's ultimately the wrong thing for the industry. I think whenever you have the rights holder also owning the pipes that they're sending their content over, you create some real serious problems. It's yet to be seen how this shakes out. I think that if this trend continues, and I think there will be some more serious consolidation in the industry, if this trend continues, I think that the independent content creator and ultimately the consumer will suffer, because we're going to have less choice, and the service providers will have all of the control. It's a frightening future. But I think the conclusion is foregone. I think that the merger will go through.
And so everyone is in agreement. The merger will likely happen. Hopefully, some of us net neutrality supporters will be able to hopefully gain a little bit of protection out of that merger if as it's working its way through Congress and regulatory areas, that we might be able to see some of those things be hopefully a component of that deal being approved. On a lighter note, Disney. Our fans with Mickey Mouse, our friends there, are now in a deal with Netflix to distribute some ABC reruns, and I would assume some Disney Channel programs as well, it looks like, on Netflix. And the deal was about $150 million. What was really striking to me is that Netflix is paying considerably less per episode than the networks do, or even the local affiliates do, for a syndication deal. And this is reported in the LA Times. What was interesting to me was that typically some syndication costs are almost over $1.4 million per episode. The article reports that Modern Family, which is on NBC, is going for that in syndication, which is pretty shocking. So this is a pretty good deal for Netflix in the sense that they're paying a lot less than others. No one's really been able to figure out what Netflix's business model is for streaming. But what do you guys think? I mean, Tim, this is certainly another thing to watch on Netflix. Is this good for us? Not good for us? Or what should we look for next?
This is really, really good for Passback Entertainment.
Passback?
Yes. That's when mom is driving in the car, mm-hmm. and the kids won't shut up, and so
right.
she hands them the 3G connected iPad,
right.
and she passes it to the back seat so the kids
yes.
can watch.
Yep.
Shut up.
Hey, Tim, I have to interrupt you. I just tweeted about you not bringing your A game, but that was some A game comment. Well played, sir.
Let me ask you, Zach, how do you get something on Netflix to stream? Is that something you've done? Is there a path to getting independent content there?
Let's talk about Netflix. Okay, first off, who remembers the days where we had to dual boot into Windows just to stream Netflix on our Macs?
I do.
Yep. Because Netflix was not always available on the Macintosh operating system. Now, you say that to someone now, the normal consumers, air quotes, that understand, blah, 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 I just got an email, so I'm getting distracted. that understand, how to get to Netflix now. It's totally different because we've been doing it for a while, and the way I've been accessing Netflix, like I said, first it was Windows dual boot, and then finally they released it on the Mac, so that's awesome. And now we're seeing Netflix on the Wii, we're seeing Netflix on PS3, we're seeing Netflix built into Vizio TVs, we're seeing it built into Samsung TVs. It's available on the Boxy Box, it's available on the Apple TV. Let's just target that to one thing: the fact that Apple Incorporated made a device and specifically hard-coded a service into it. That's got to mean that service is pretty dang good. You know what I'm saying? That's a third-party service that they are advertising as a big pull of their device, which I think is absolutely incredible and not enough people are talking about, because Apple stock is doing pretty well. They're making some great decisions, and if you're throwing a company such as Netflix directly into your television entertainment device, you've got a lot of faith in that company. I go to the gym and I pull out my iPad when I'm on the elliptical, and I can watch Hercules season one all day, every day. I mean, Kevin Sorbo in that tunic he wears is just ridiculous. Good acting. Basically, my point is the fact that we can have this pass back form of media where we can just, you know, remotely connect to this amazing streaming service that has high quality content, that has great content, and is doing nothing but adding more to that. If you read down in this article, it stands out. I love to see it. And I talked about Alex Lindsay when Alex and I are on the show together. We kind of go in kind of a tangent and how, you know, what we're watching on Netflix, or, you know, how nice and easy it is to access the stuff on Netflix. But let me tell you, like, I really, really can't stress enough how easy it's made watching things, and how you can kind of use that same passback model to think about, like, you're going to sleep at night and you just want some background noise on. And normally what someone would do would be turn on their cable television, or you can just run to your instant queue and throw on something that you've seen, or go into suggestions for you and just turn it on and not really care about it. It's sort of the same thing. So are people going to be cutting the cord now that Netflix is becoming more accessible and they're kind of lowering their streaming service? I think so. I think that eventually Netflix is going to move away from physical DVDs and Blu-ray and focus mainly on being a streaming content provider.
And it's without a doubt. In fact, they already have kind of drawn a line in the sand, and they're now charging more for their DVD subscription packages than for their streaming subscription packages. So I think they see the future, and I actually think they're very progressive in terms of seeing, you know, the big picture trend and the shift here. And they've been doing streaming for a very long time before almost anyone else in the game was streaming content online. So they have the infrastructure in place. They have the subscriber base, and, you know, that's ultimately at the end of the day why they're able to cut these deals, is because, you know, they're able to actually pass cash back to the studios, which are, you know, hurting. They need to make up for the loss in DVD sales, which at the end of the day are not being caused by Netflix. Netflix isn't, you know, single-handedly killing the DVD channel. They're just, you know, helping it to die a little bit faster. But I think at the end of the day, when you look at Netflix's business model, it's not advertiser supported, right? So they just literally, the economics of Netflix don't allow them to pay the same fees that a typical syndicator, either, you know, a terrestrial broadcaster or a cable network can pay, because they're subsidizing, the subscription with advertising revenue. So Netflix really can't spend the same cash. Because a lot of it's also long tail content, it's more a catalog play ultimately than it is a typical syndication play.
Which they've done a go ahead.
No, go ahead.
They've done a great job because of a few different things. First and foremost, Netflix has been an innovator. They, like you said, they've been streaming. They were one of the earliest, and I would say, you know, they've obviously been the standout over the past handful of years. But the reason being is because of their constant innovation and their constant striving to give us what we want versus what's easy. The fact that they can throw a whole lot of movies on there and some TV shows will keep people subscribed. It will keep people subscribed. It will keep people, new customers showing up. But the fact that they're constantly striving, like striking this deal with Disney and ABC, striking this deal to keep content funneling in, to bring the dates between airing on TV and airing on Netflix shorter and shorter and shorter. They're making moves. They're paying money out, and they're caring about their customers versus making an easy deal or making a quick buck or saving or skimming some cash here. They've, over the past few years, constantly struggled and strived to give us exactly, you know, the content that we want as best as they can. And I think that eventually, you know, a lot of gates are going to be knocked down and we're going to get more and more and more. But I have to say that if you compare it to something like Hulu, or if you compare it to another streaming service, comparatively speaking, they've done a great job at giving us more and more and more and more and more for such a small amount of money that we're paying. And I think that's why we're going to keep coming back. And that's why I keep paying for the service, even sometimes if I don't even stream something. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just there. I consider that just my $9-$8 a month I don't worry about. I've had the same DVD sitting in my apartment for probably 9 months, you know?
I've had that too. I've had a couple Blu-rays that just kind of sit on collecting dust on the tabletop. Well, one thing about Netflix that really has been striking to me is just how effective they've been at getting people to connect devices to their television that download video off the internet. That to me is what everyone has been striving to do through all these different boxes that have been coming out. And it seems to be that these boxes are like the Apple TV and the Roku are becoming successful because they have Netflix streaming on board. And that's something that I'm hoping for independent providers, that we do have a means to get ourselves connected to Netflix at some point. The other player out there, of course, is YouTube. The company, many argue, could say started all this internet video craziness. And they're finally going to lift some time limits for some videos. Now, I was fortunate enough when I got into YouTube years ago, only maybe 4 years ago, I signed up for one of those director accounts. So I've never had the length restriction. But it looks like they're starting to ease up a little bit on this. Perhaps their copyright stuff is getting a little bit easier to manage on their end. So they're giving users a little bit more time for uploads. Zach, this must be good news for you, right?
I think that this is awesome. A lot of the content I produce is short form, which is kind of, you know, what we need on the internet. But I kind of feel like, in a way, if you guys really think about that, possibly the reason not only the general ADD of the population, but the reason that short form entertainment has become so regular and so much more insisted is we use YouTube as an indicator. Like, we have a time limit. Like, we're restricted below 10 minutes or whatever. And we're kind of encouraged to make our content short and concise. But think of YouTube, you know, in the early days, rather than having any sort of time limit or any sort of upload limit at all, the norm was, if we're producing internet content, for episodes to be 15 to 20 minutes. I feel like we've kind of assimilated and jumped into kind of a gap that has become the norm. But maybe we're going to see, you know, since they're letting down the gates a little bit, maybe we're going to see sort of a change in content creation. And I wouldn't be opposed to throwing a little bit more work and creating something that's more long form. I know Tim and I would like to start collaborating on French Made TV, the film. What do you think, Tim?
I would watch that.
I think that would be, I mean, I'm obviously joking, but essentially what I'm saying is it's neat.
I just got stone cold silence from Tim.
Yeah, I wonder if we still. Tim, are you?
I was laughing too hard.
No, he's got himself muted. He's like, listen, I don't want to subject you guys to my obnoxious fan noise. Tim, go get a good microphone. What are you doing, man? Where's the A game?
Yeah.
No, it's great. Go ahead, Tim.
You know, if you're a fan of Robert McKee, he's one of the screenwriting gurus in Hollywood. In his book Story, he talks about how whenever there's a technological advance in entertainment, spectacle comes first, then story. And YouTube for the last, you know, 5 years has been spectacle. That's what we've gone to YouTube for, is the spectacle. And now we're slowly moving into story, and I think extending the time limit is going to facilitate that.
Brady, your thoughts on this extension? Is this must be good for artists too, for music acts, maybe putting on longer form concerts and whatnot? Is this good for everybody?
Absolutely. I think YouTube has really stepped up its game in the last year with live streaming, increasing the upload limits. I think at the end of the day, YouTube wants to capture eyeballs, and I think that short form content, is, like Tim said, incredibly effective at engaging people on that kind of emotional level around spectacle. But to really, you know, serve as a storytelling medium, I think, you know, longer form content needs to have a place. And they've already done that with their shows category with, you know, the major distributors, and so opening it up to the community of content creators, I think, is the right move. And I think it's actually going to unleash an entirely new category of content on YouTube, which we haven't seen before. So, you know, perhaps it'll be independent film will be distributed on YouTube at some point. Perhaps it's, you know, just longer form web television. I'm not sure what form that new category will take, but I think it's incredibly exciting. And at the end of the day, if you can get the eyeballs to stick around, you know, for 20, 30 minutes, eventually an hour, you're also going to drive up advertising revenue as well.
eyeballs equal money, and for that reason, not only is YouTube extending its time limits on things, iTunes is now doing 90-second song previews. I want to get Brady's thoughts on this. CNET.com is reporting that those 30-second clips are going to go to 90 seconds, and this was supposed to happen earlier, but of course the industry said they weren't licensed for those longer previews. Brady, does this make a difference in music sales?
Absolutely. Yeah, so the numbers, and I don't have them directly in front of me, yeah, absolutely. So the longer the sample and the higher quality the sample is, the more likely that that the consumer is actually going to make the purchase. So at the end of the day, Apple's all about driving revenue, and the likelihood is even with a 90-second sample, it's not enough of a song that someone's going to rip it. So. I think it makes a tremendous amount of sense. I know it's been a battle on the back end, with the labels. Any time that you ask, for just a bit, they're looking for increased compensation, either royalties or licensing. The reality is that like the television industry or like the film industry, history is really not on our side when it comes to. To digital distribution, we have an enormous infrastructure that's been built over the last 80 years that really caters, to the artists, which is a good thing. And there's an expectation that any time music is used, whether it's played in a theater, played in a store, played on a commercial, that the creator and the performer, in this case, the composer or the songwriter. And the musical act that actually lays down the track are going to be compensated in some fashion. But at the end of the day, the market is shrinking. We've seen that by $4 billion in just the last 10 years. The idea, I think, the future, just like is taking place, in the online entertainment space with web television and serialized content, is that a larger percentage of revenue is going to go directly to the artist's pocket. In the past, it's been 10 to 20% of each album that's sold. It actually goes into the artist's pocket, and I think that is going to shift pretty dramatically as distribution becomes a lot more frictionless.
And Tim, do you remember a time when you used to walk into a record store and plop down $18 for a CD and you couldn't hear any of it? We got it good now, don't we?
Yeah, I'm thinking the ones who are going to benefit from this the most are the 13 to 14-year-old kids who don't have a credit card. Mm-hmm. Because especially ones with ADD, because then they can just listen to the part of the song they like and move on to the next song and not have to buy anything.
So it continues the destruction of society then, doesn't it? So, Zach, are you...
Absolutely.
And I should add, by the way, that my only friend on Ping is Tim Street. So I rely on you for
man. I need to add Tim.
Yeah, you got to add Tim.
Like you got like old school jazz with Tim Street. That's, you know what I'm saying?
Yep, he hooks it all up. So hey Zach. So are you a pinger, or do you think the 90-second preview is more effective for your music buying experience than Ping would be?
Oh God, I don't know if I should say this, but I don't know if I've purchased music since 2004.
Oh wow. Because you're making your own, right?
Yeah, because I'm producing all of my own beats in GarageBand.
running those loops.
I've bought songs on iTunes before, and then I have to deal with the DRM and all that stuff, which is kind of annoying, but I think that the 90-second preview is incredible. I am often annoyed by the 30-second preview. The 90-second preview definitely is going to open the floodgates. I keep referring to floodgates. I don't know what's happening. It's snowing outside. I think it's going to be a great thing, obviously, because it's going to give us more of a. I mean, it's sort of built into the experience. I mean, you can't really talk about it that much, but it's cool to me because I often don't know what song I'm listening to, and I'm out in a coffee shop or something like that. Maybe I'll Shazam it or whatever, and I'll go to YouTube to try to find that song because YouTube has kind of been the go-to place. And I know that Google has tried to replace that with – I forget the name of the streaming service, but I can just search a song right now. When you search in the Google search bar, it comes up on I don't know what it's called. Rap scene. No. Anyway, it comes up.
Something that Google's got.
Right. It comes up. Yep. It comes up as your top search result, and it lets you play it once.
Oh, interesting.
Versus.
Is that
I think so. It's something like that. But it lets you play it once, and like that's your fix. Like you navigated. You're getting ad impressions on you, and you're listening to the song. But people usually go to YouTube, and it's like a slideshow of the band, like at a picnic.
Right.
with the song in the background, or like someone's cat, or like someone driving through the forest in a Denali, just like jumping over tree branches and going crazy. That's usually what you find. But now with it being built right into iTunes, I'm a fan of in-app experiences, and I really like Ping. I think it's a neat service, and it's doing the one goal of driving people to stay within iTunes to interact with their content more, which ultimately leads to buying, you know, content. If they keep providing this content, they're going to keep buying the content. So it's really smart on a business sense, and it's going to keep people within iTunes buying versus heading to YouTube and just listening to a song. And I think that was a really, really smart strategical move. And I'll probably be more inclined to search within iTunes because I know that it's organized better. There's better metadata, and the audio quality is going to be higher. And 90 seconds of a song usually is a big enough gap to sort of get your handle and understand what it is you're downloading. But like I said, to be completely honest, I don't know if I've bought that much music. I guess I just must not listen to anything ever besides Tim Street's show tunes.
Right, and if you go on Ping, you'll get plenty from him on that. And you know, it's true too. To some degree, I think people hit when you get to a certain age, there's less music discovery going on. At least for people that are not, you know, really into music, which is part of what Brady's trying to do, is to try to get some more get people really focused on finding new stuff and connecting artists to listeners. And
that's. Right? That's excellent. Just earlier this morning, literally, I have an IM window open where a friend of mine IM'd me. He goes, "Lack Zooey." I said, "Sup?" He said, "I need new music. Hit me with it."
Right.
And so I just IM'd him about 8 different band names, and he goes, "Which
You're
album?
Your own king."
Yeah, you could be on Pink.
Which album by the Decemberists? I said, "Castaways, Pirate Shanties." I like that. He goes, "So if you had to pick from their discography, which would you pick?" So, I mean, essentially, yeah, I'm being a real-world Ping. Maybe I should just point him toward his iTunes application on his dock. But no, Brady, tear that up, because people don't know what they want to listen to, you know?
I completely agree. Yeah, okay. So you're actually one of the first people that I've connected with that has really liked Ping. So at some point, I will follow up with you. I want to learn more about why Ping works for you.
The reason I like Ping is because I look at it from a business – I don't want to cloud up the show with this, so I'll keep it very brief. I look at it from a business perspective. Like I said, it makes no sense to me because I don't need a quote social network within my music buying experience, because I'm not the kind of person that is going to go in here and drop all this money on something that's digital and that they should find a new way to monetize because data is free now. But I understand what they're doing, and for the vast majority of people that aren't tech savvy like we are, Ping is really candy and neat to them. It's designed well, and it serves kind of a purpose, and allows the artists to connect directly with the fans within a space that drives purchasing of their content. So for content creators that are dealing with the decline in CD sales, they are going to appreciate this. And for me, who used to play in a band, for me, who makes music videos for bands as a career, I can respect it from that point of view. But will I use it actively? No.
One thing I found neat with it is a new feature that they added is that your entire library is now pingable. So as you're listening to music, right next to every song title is the ping button that you can hit to recommend stuff. And Tim, if you log in, you'll see my Klezmer Christmas music CD that I liked, and I'm sharing that with you. So a little mixture of cultures
well,
and religions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know what I'm really looking forward to is when we can ping web videos that we like, and you can buy them in the iTunes store.
I like that. Listen to me. I'm like, let's buy videos.
Yeah, let's do that. That's the next step, and maybe if Steve Jobs is listening, because I know he is, to implement
Steve Jobs,
that. We love you.
Sell our videos, please.
Yeah, please. We need more money. So
99 cents. It's all
right. It's all it takes. Now let's shift gears here. We're gonna go from from music now to books, because Google launched their bookstore, a challenge to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and a number of other places or publishers.
And iBooks.
and iBooks as well. So my iPad now has about 4 different readers. Now, for me, the problem I have with all these bookstores is that everything costs the same across all of them. I have yet to see a real disparity in price to where there's an actual advantage for, you know, to buying one over the other. I've been kind of going with Kindle as the default just because I have an actual Kindle reader that I use occasionally when I'm out in the sun, and my iPad, which I use when I'm not in the sun, which is kind of bizarre that you have to have a second device to read in the sun. But what do you all think about this? I mean, we have a lot of choices now, but they all charge the same amount of money. Brady, what's the deal? Are we going to see any kind of diversity in pricing here, or is it just going to be your preference of reader?
It's a good question. I think at the end of the day, there is going to be fixation around some price point. I think it will be largely driven by the publishers themselves until the point where publishers are no longer needed, which is not that far off. In the future, I think what's fascinating to me is really how Google kind of gained entry into this space. It was really actually kind of an accident because they were on the wrong end of a class action lawsuit after they surreptitiously published tens of thousands of books without compensating anyone. I think that Google has the power of the default here. So, they own 60% of search traffic in the U.S. And that enables them to make some very specific choices about where to direct traffic. And I think that's going to be what's the most fascinating to me is both in Apple's case and Google's case, they both, kind of own an ecosystem. And that's going to create some very interesting questions, from an antitrust perspective. Around how to treat all vendors equally, to not have problems around preference and default. So I think the price point will probably settle similar to the way that tracks and albums and iTunes have pricing has kind of become standard for the industry. I think the same thing will happen in the case of ebooks, but it's really going to be up to that one kind of dominant player. And right now, I think it's probably going to be Amazon. I personally don't think that Apple really nailed it with iBooks, and I think Amazon is somewhere we're already kind of predisposed to shop for books. So still yet to be seen, but I think it's going to be a really interesting battle to watch.
I do too. And Zach, are you a reader?
I'm a reader.
Do you like bookstores?
Do I like physical bookstores or do I like digital bookstores?
Physical bookstores.
Physical bookstores are a great place to meet young women.
Well,
so yes, I like them.
Then you're going to love this about the Google Bookstore, because one of the things that they're doing, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because if you're perusing bookstores for friends and books, they are going to allow small bookstores to sell Google Books through their websites and presumably through their stores directly, which maybe the thing would show up at your computer when you got home. Kind of good for bookstores, right?
I think it's neat that they're going to be connecting the two, because I know that I can imagine what it feels like to be a non-national chain bookstore facing the past few years with the Kindle growing to such popularity and with the iPad growing to such popularity. I think that connecting the two is a great thing, because I at the end of the day, I don't think I've read a physical book in a while, because I grab the PDFs or I buy them from the Kindle store. I used to have a Kindle. Now I read exclusively on the iPad, just because I want to be minus one device. But I think it's awesome that you read your Kindle in the sunlight, because it's beautiful in the sunlight. Like, I'm really jealous. But I want to keep the romanticization of bookstores, because I made the joke about young ladies being there. But in all honesty, I feel like it's a convergence of culture where people go to learn. Or people go to be around like-minded individuals. It's just a social experience as well as a purchasing experience. And you just don't get that from going on iBooks store or going in the Kindle store. Like, there's nothing really sexy about that, inherently sexy about that. But going into a bookstore and being able to grab an online copy, a digital copy, as well as grabbing a physical copy, I think is going to be a really valuable experience. I think what they should begin doing, honestly, is at the point of service system, when I purchase 4-Hour Body by Tim Ferriss, I get the physical book, but also maybe when I scan and check out, that goes to my, you know, to my cloud, and I have the digital copy of my devices just in case I need it.
Right, and if you're out somewhere and you want to read a couple of pages, it'll be on your phone and it would be physical there too. That could be a really neat potential. One thing that has struck me is that Kindle also has some new deluxe ebooks. And Tim, I want to throw this to you because I think this might be of interest. I got a biography from a former president, and it had a bunch of video inside the Kindle book. Now, that wouldn't even play on Amazon's Kindle device, but I can watch the video on my iPad, which is kind of funny, right? But the question is, for Tim, we got to have some standards here. Are there standards in the ebook industry for video? How do you see, as someone who's in the video industry, see this whole thing shaking out?
Well, Anthony Zucker, the guy who created CSI, he did a digital novel, or digi novel, I think is what he called it, called Level 26. And that's kind of this weird erotic thriller type book that has video in it as well. And he kind of pushed the limits of what he can do in that space, where he can't really talk about this weird, creepy subject matter in CSI to the detail in which he wanted to. So he's done this series. In terms of creating standards, it's early days. I think we're going to have to see how it shakes out. But I would expect what would need to happen first is that a shelf space develops for these interactive stories that have both text and video and links and audio and all that kind of stuff. You know, right now, if you want to go buy an interactive story, there's no place to go look for that other than, you know, go search on Google. So we don't, you know, Anthony's calling them digi novels, but that name, he's trademarked it. It hasn't really caught on yet. So I'm not sure. I mean, this is something I experimented with back in 2001 in the DVD space, and it never, you know, there were interactive stories on DVD, but because of the latency, it never really caught on. So I wonder if we will see it develop in terms of iPad apps or some other type thing, but there has to be that shelf space first.
Shelf space is key, and people have to have the devices too, which is always a step in that direction. So, you know, we talk about iPads as consumption devices and as web reading tools, and we can watch some video on them and maybe type up a little email here or there. But there's also a group of people that are beginning to weaponize iPhones and iPads for the ongoing info war that started, of course, with the WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and all the things related to that. So apparently you can now use your iPad to help attack people with denial of service attacks, which quite frankly scares the heck out of me that
it's
people
awesome.
Could... Yes, we should note, of course, that as we begin this discussion, that if you are participating willingly in a denial of service attack, you are committing a crime. You will likely go to jail, as actually many people are starting to find out because they thought they were going to become some denial of servicers online. Let's put that proper disclaimer out there ahead of this discussion. But this is kind of changing the game a little bit, that you can go from downloading some software on a PC or hacking into somebody's computer to actually using your iPhone or iPad as a digital weapon. Tim, what are your thoughts on this whole scenario?
Well, we're working on a laser app for the iPad, so you can really just point it at the person and zap them. And I think it's crazy, you know, but it is one of the realities of the world that we're living in, and it makes you really, you know, start to think about what spyware do you have on your computer that you don't know about right now.
Right, and that also leads us to the massive install base of iPhones and now iPads that are getting out there. They might be a target vector for people unwillingly or unwittingly sending out these kinds of attacks. Zach, have you ever weaponized your iPad?
The first moment of weaponization on any iOS device that I've ever experienced was a few years ago when I navigated to the jailbroken application store and installed a lightsaber on my cellular device. I can say that it's been a pleasantly daunting, if that makes any sense, experience since then. I've committed several felonies with my I think this is just ridiculous. I mean, we have essentially tiny laptops in our pocket when we carry these phones around. And after we're finished at the end of the day dealing with our cancerous cysts that these phones have created within our bodies, I think that we're going to be sort of stuck with the smart people are going to figure it out. I hate to say that, but it's just like I don't want to think about denial of service attacks launching from my phone. I just think this is ridiculous. Like, I don't know what people are doing with their free time, but I know that when I wake up, everything is scheduled. Like, I'm lucky if I can sit down and read Uncrate when I'm drinking my like morning tea or coffee or something. So props to them for creating lives for themselves where they can sit and code out DDoS attack modules for everyone's friendly iPhone or iPad device. Like, but like, I don't know. I just think this is ridiculous. I really have nothing more to say about it. It's just ridiculous. Don't send DDoS attacks from your phone.
Right. Don't send it to me.
That makes you a very stupid person. Bye.
And Brady, you know, a lot of people complain about the Apple App Store being so closed and that it's very difficult to get apps into it because perhaps it might violate some of the iOS security. Here's a great example of a malicious piece of software that, although in this case people are installing willingly, you know, if there were enough jailbroken iPhone or iPads, or if there were enough people being able to violate iOS security, this could actually become a real problem if this could install itself in almost a viral sense. What are your thoughts on is Apple taking the right stance on its App Store policy for this very reason?
Yeah, it's a good question. Two part answer. One is I think that it's less of a DDoS attack, especially the ones that are being orchestrated by, you know, the WikiLeaks community are, you know, more of a digital nuisance than digital war. So I think that's important to keep in mind. Sure, it's, you know, it's illegal and it's frustrating, but it's largely symbolic. You know, we're taking down websites. We're not launching Stuxnet and spinning up machines to unnecessary RPMs so we can, you know, destroy.
That's what you
someone's
think.
Plutonium. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, it is possible, right? Totally possible. So, you know, with that caveat, I think that you know, Apple's strategy has always been around, you know, owning the entire vertical. So, you know, soup to nuts solution. They own the hardware. They own the software. And, you know, granted, it gives you you know, a really seamless experience. At the same time, it also makes them the arbiter of what is right and what is wrong, and that's a very scary proposition for, you know, a company, a private entity, you know, to own the digital commons. And that's really, you know, the feature of the internet, I think, is that because it is a private public space, at the end of the day, you have companies with, you know, their own you know, interests, ultimately that of their shareholders, which is to make money, controlling the dialogue. And that's why you know, Amazon and PayPal ultimately both, you know, shut down access to either, you know, their services or their servers, you know, for WikiLeaks, because it wasn't a battle that they were, you know, willing to fight, and it wasn't even their battle to fight. You know, it was going to cause them some major problems with regulators, and, you know, at the end of the day, they don't really care about free speech. They care about keeping their company intact and making a profit, and so, you know, in the case of Apple, I think it's, you know, a similar problem. You know, who watches the watchers, right? And if the watchers are in cahoots with the government, then, you know, citizens lose a lot of their freedoms, and it's actually a very scary future. So you know, outside of the question of whether or not I morally agree with, you know, WikiLeaks approach, I think it's very frightening to see you know, corporate America roll over so easily.
And there you go. So let's talk about using iPads in a little bit more of a productive manner. And I'm curious to what you all think about this announcement. There's a new startup called Snapstick, and it's a private beta, so none of us have it, nor can we get it unless anybody on the show has one. I don't have one. It's a device that you plug into your TV, and you can also plug in another end of it to a computer or to an iOS device, and it'll broadcast stuff very much like AirPlay, although they say it pushes the full website and can give on-screen info like more than mobile apps could, so you could do Flash and some other stuff if you're hooked up to your PC. But what do you all think about this? I mean, we could all hook our PCs up to a computer or to a TV just the same. Is this something that's even needed now in the age of or the era of AirPlay? Let me turn that over to Tim to start.
Well, with AirPlay right now, you can't go to Hulu and watch Hulu on your TV. You can't, you can't go to a lot of websites and watch video on your Apple TV with AirPlay. The sound will come up, but the video has not been enabled yet on a lot of sites. So, with this particular thing, I would think that the forces at large are probably working on a lawsuit right now to shut it down somehow. I mean, what gets me, though, is that you can take your MacBook Pro or you can take your Mac Mini and you can hook those up to a TV monitor and you can surf the internet on your TV. Not a problem. But the minute you try to connect a device that isn't that and to watch web video on your TV, all these alarms start going off because the cable MSOs are losing money because of that. And when you take a look at a company like Fox, who makes somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 billion a year off of cable licensing deals, that they don't want to lose that. They don't want to cannibalize that. So they're going to do everything they can to prevent. Install this, the phrase in Hollywood that you hear at a lot of these places is "not before I retire" is the phrase. So there's a lot of old guys that are clinging on, and the sad thing is somebody else will probably come along with a business model that does work on over the top, and we'll see some of these television networks go the way of Blockbuster.
Brady, what do you think? Are you AirPlaying, or are you looking forward to other ways of getting video from a PC or iPad to your television?
You know, it's a good question. I think it's compelling. I don't spend that much time in front of my TV. I spend most of my time in front of one of my smaller screens, like my laptop. Got a little tickle there. So, from that perspective, I think it's compelling. I will say this: the guys at SnapStick have probably the coolest About Us photo in the entire world. If you haven't checked it out, you should go check it out right now. It'll blow your mind. They're the happiest looking guys ever. I think Tim's right. I think that this is going to be grounds for a very serious lawsuit. I think any time that you cross from one distinct platform into another, where you make that bridge extremely easy, then the lawyers start calling.
They do, and they know everyone's phone number too, apparently. And Zach, let me ask you: you make content that people sell to some degree, and also content that people make money on because it's being measured in a certain way. Do things like this scare you as a content creator that depends on measurement and sales of video to keep your livelihood going?
Absolutely not. I'm a content consumer as well as a content creator, and I am completely behind the ease of access of bringing this content to our televisions, because right now the day and age that we live in, television is the ultimate viewing experience. I currently have an Apple TV. I have an excellent workflow on my computer where I dump all of my TV shows that I've acquired and movies that I've acquired into my workflow. And it automatically aggregates all of that data and dumps it in my iTunes, and it's all neatly compiled on my Apple TV list. It's nice. I really have no need for SnapStick because I have that workflow already. I can see how it would be very attractive for a large number of people because, I just bring up my iPad, I navigate to, whatever, bring over my iPad, navigate to whatever, and it essentially zaps to my television. I am just kind of behind. I'm not a fan of anything that puts the internet on my television, though, because I feel like there should definitely, absolutely be a separation between the two. I have more screen real estate right now on my computer setup than I do on my TV. I have a 27-inch monitor and a 30-inch monitor, and I don't have a 57-inch TV. You know what I'm saying? So yep. I don't need to use my television for internet. My television is for watching things. I don't necessarily want any kind of weird browsing like experience. It's not what my television is for. I think that an interface like Boxy or an interface like Apple TV, that is a good setup, and it's going to obviously get even more simple. I'm one day we're going to have three lines of menu, you know, like TV, movie, podcast, or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I'm not really a fan of the idea of people using this to navigate. I just think it's a novelty thing, and it's going to die out very quickly. Like, I know that when people buy DVI cables for their MacBooks on their TV, they use it on their TV like very rarely. Or when my friends, they use Mac Mini on their television, they use it mainly just for Boxy. Like, they're not sitting in their living room like browsing the web. That you put a laptop in your lap, put an iPad in your lap, use your iPhone, use your computer. It doesn't make much sense to use a browser on your television. That being said, there is a novelty factor. People will use it. They will like it. Snapstick is gonna draw a lot of people in that way. And I really like the idea that we can, you know, work around the Hulu block and watch Hulu on your television. That's beautiful. But at the end of the day, it's about ease of access to the content for me. And a device like an Apple TV or the Boxy Box that makes it very simple for people just to turn it on and press play is going to be more likely that people cut the cord of their cable to switch to something like that.
Right.
Rather than switching to something that adds another barrier of entry, like, oh, I have to plug in this device and like snap it to my TV. Like, it's just kind of like when I'm doing consulting on websites, and I'm like, listen, we got to draw these people in within two clicks, or we're gonna lose them. It's just like adding layers of separation in your website. You want your content at the front that's gonna grab them, and if we've got to do so many things before accessing our content on the television, turning on the TV and flipping through channels is going to still appear to be more attractive to people. So the goal should be to make it more simple and to take more things away from your television experience and sort of draw it away and try to differentiate it from your computer, because that's what it is. A large percent of the market is not going to move over because they don't want the computer on their television. Like, they're not all, you know, they're not all this young, innovative demographic. They're just wanting to watch things. So will they move to something like Snapstick? No. Will Snapstick grab part of the market? Yes. And it's really useful because I want to watch Hulu on my TV, damn it.
that's all it comes down to. It's just having some flexibility to move the content where we want. Our last story, and this is a doozy, guys. George Lucas, who we all know and love from Star Wars, who's been experimenting with digital actors for some time, namely Jar Jar, comes to mind. But now he thinks that he might be able to take dead actors and recast them digitally in new films. Clearly, implications up the wazoo. So let me start with Brady. This seems to be like, how do you even negotiate the copyright on something like this? I mean, what does copyright mean? What does the name mean at this point when you're taking a dead actor and putting them on? I mean, Obi-Wan Kenobi wasn't dead even in the time he was in the movie, you know? And now, now he's gone, and I don't think he would probably want his likeness used in another Star Wars film. So what do you think?
It's super fascinating. Dead people don't have a lot of choice, unfortunately. I actually just worked on a project with Digital Domain and have seen some of the behind-the-scenes action in their new platform called Pulse, which is their previs technology, which they used on Tron. And just seeing, you know, the process of creating the younger Jeff Bridges was pretty phenomenal. And the movie opens this Friday, so go check it out. But I think that beyond that, the implications here for licensing, for rights management, for royalties is pretty staggering. In fact, I had a conversation with some guys over at SAG about 6 months ago about this specific issue, and they are running full steam ahead trying to solve it before it becomes a problem. Specifically, the video game industry is actually kind of leaps and bounds ahead of the film industry when it comes to cutting deals, structuring deals for voice and acting talent to compensate them for this kind of work. Because at the end of the day, you know, you're still using someone's likeness and they need to get paid for it. But there's also the question of, you know, well, it's not really their performance anymore. You're essentially, you know, taking their likeness, and perhaps even, especially in the case of a deceased actor, you're applying it to someone else's performance. So it becomes rather complex. I don't think there's a clear answer yet, but I guarantee you George Lucas will force one.
Absolutely. As often change happens by someone forcing something along. Hey, Zach, would you ever use a dead actor in one of your music videos?
Yes, absolutely. I would use Richard Harris, the original and best Albus Dumbledore.
There you go. There you go. And Tim, And Tim, you got to have the last word on this one.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but they've been testing this for years, and they first tested it out with Lassie and Rin Tin Tin just to make sure nobody got hurt, and no complaints from those guys at all.
Well, there you go. And they probably barked a few times, but hopefully apparently nobody noticed. So, hey, we're at the end of the show, guys. I want to thank all of our guests for being here today. Just a reminder to our listeners that we have a Facebook page, and you can find that at facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia. So like us. I hope you do, because I like all of you. And tell us what you think and give us some story ideas, and it might just show up on the show. Tim Street, where can people find you on the internets?
You can check us out at mdialogue.com, or you can read my blog, onetimstreet.com.
And Brady, you?
You can check us out at Chordly, chordly.com, or my personal blog at www.brimdeforest.com.
And Zach's got a million things going on, but he aggregates everything where?
I want you to just go to my Twitter feed, where I tell you about my love for spinach. And if you'd like to click through to my website, you can do that as well.
And I love spinach, too. And if you want to find out more about me, my spinach recipes, and more, you can find me at Lon Seidman, L-O-N-S-E-I-D-M-A-N, on Twitter. And if you're in Connecticut or nearby, we're actually in the process of putting together a conference for independent media that are producing news or other kinds of content in the Connecticut area. So if you're interested in that, hit me up on Twitter, and we'll get you the information on doing that. We'll talk about it again on a future show. And
what?
Yes?
You're a funny man. You're just a witty guy. I like that.
Well, you're witty too, and I like you too. I'm going to go to your Facebook page and like you now, just for that. So
I don't have a page, or I didn't put it up at least.
Well, you should get one so I can like it. So,
oh, gosh.
And this mess you've been listening to was recorded on December 14th, 2010. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a Pixelcore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.